shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
We had a nice visit this afternoon over lunch, and it's always good to talk to a man who's genuine. A lot of times you hear a preacher, words come out real smooth and everything. You sit down and there's just no substance to them. But I guarantee that this is a man of substance, and that's the type of people I like. And I think that's the type of speakers we've had throughout the conference. So without taking any further time, I'm going to turn it on over to Steve.
I want to talk to you tonight about the heavens and the earth. Particularly from the book of Genesis, this will be perhaps a different approach than you've heard before. There's many different approaches. I'm not going to get into a scientific approach. That I leave for the scientists, and I'm not really that up on science in that sense. But there are certain divisions in creation that we need to know about. There is first, if you check in Genesis 1, verses 3 to 5, you see the division between light and darkness. That is, of course, important because you have essentially a vertical division here. Can everybody see that pretty well? Okay. Light and darkness. Genesis 1, 3 to 5. Got to catch up with myself here. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. So here it is. The division right down the middle here is the light and the darkness division here. Now, then you have a division in the waters. It's called the upper waters, the lower waters, okay? And in verses 6 and 7, and God said, "Let there be a firmament or an expanse in the midst of the waters," in the middle of the waters. Okay, in other words, there's waters above and waters below, right? If you have an expanse between waters or in the midst of the waters. And let it divide the waters from the waters. Okay, so obviously there's upper and there's lower waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. So here we have it. You find the upper waters shown and portrayed in the book of Revelation. It's coming out from the throne of Yahweh, right? We call it the waters of life, or the water of life, clear as crystal. These are waters now that are in the highest heavens, okay? Obviously, they are in some place called heaven, right? As opposed to terra firma, earth. But yet you have lower waters also. And we call them seas, or oceans, or fountains, and rivers, and all that kind of stuff. So you have the upper waters of the river of life in Revelation 22:1. Then you have in between, you have a firmament between the waters. And in verse 8, it is called heaven. And God called the firmament heaven. Okay? So, this is heaven. Obviously, this is heaven also. Right? So you've got at least two heavens here. Any response? Fairly clear? Any disagreement? A major disagreements or anything?
No.
If so, keep it to yourself. I don't want to hear it.
Amen.
Okay. Okay. The lower waters have clouds. They have the sun, moon, and stars, according to verses 14 to 18. It says, "And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." So sun, moon, and stars even are a part of this second heaven called the firmament. And he also says that he may, in verse 20, "Let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life or a soul, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven." The fowls fly in the heaven. So this expanse includes a whole lot and a bunch. Okay? The second heaven really is anything above terra firma here. It includes atmosphere, clouds, birds are flying around in this firmament, and also sun, moon, and stars. So it goes all the way, really, including the universe out there. Now, where is that? Up, down, in between? Well, it depends on where you are. If you're on the North Pole, up is that way. If you're in the South Pole, up is that way. It's not a direction, it's a dimension. Make any sense? It's all around us. Or better yet, I consider drawing this in terms of concentric circles. You see, you have the earth, and then you have the second heaven, and then you have the third heaven around that. That would probably have been made a little more sense, but it was easier to do it this way, so I did it this way. So no arguments. Okay, you have a division in the lower waters then. The lower waters were divided into upper waters and lower waters again. And so essentially you have you've got atmosphere and you have the seas. After that, then you have the division of the lower waters from land. And so I portrayed it here, you know, the division between land and sea. Each case here you have further dividing in the creation process. One is taken out of the other. Land taken out of sea, you see, and upper waters or lower waters taken out of upper waters, and you see, everything is taken out of, you see, and it keeps getting down lower and lower. You can keep taking this down. On land, then, you have Adam created, and then you have Eve taken from Adam. You have more division later, all the way to the time of Jacob, because you have the division, you see, further division between Abraham's two sons, Isaac and Ishmael, and then you have more division with Jacob and Esau. You see, each step of the way you have a further division. Division isn't all bad. Division is a creative process also. We don't like ungodly divisions, but neither do we we also realize that some division is working for a good purpose and is a part of creation. Okay? We want it to be in the good sense. Now, I'm just going to state here, because I can't prove it, really. I can tell you about it a little bit, but I just can't prove it. There are 12 dimensions of creation. Science knows about 10 of them, but there are actually 12. And I'm just going to make that statement, and you can believe it or not, whatever you like. But we learned that from Revelation. Not the book of Revelation, but modern Revelation. Okay. You know, of course, that there are at least three heavens, right? 2 Corinthians 12, 1 to 4. Paul talks about someone, presumably himself, being caught up to the third heaven, where he learned things and things were not lawful to utter. In other words, he can't tell you about them because this is on a particular level that you really can't explain. Nobody would understand it anyway, or maybe there was no language to express it. It's in a different dimension. You have three heavens, though. Paul mentions the third heaven. And if you look at Ezekiel 8, chapter 3, turn with me there just for a moment. You have here a mention of what I call the second heaven, or the expanse, the firmament. Ezekiel used a little different terminology, but it's still the same thing. Ezekiel 8:3, he's in a vision here. It says, he put forth the form of a hand, this is the angel, and took me by a lock of mine head. I'd have a little trouble with that myself, but spiritual locks, I guess. And the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven, and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looketh toward the north. Now this is a vision. This is not a literal thing. Ezekiel is up with the captivities up by the river Chebar, or Kibar, up with the Israelites in captivity up in Assyria. Jeremiah was here in Jerusalem. Ezekiel was in captivity in Assyria. And Daniel was in Babylon. So you had three contemporary prophets all prophesying in different areas, and they had a different subject matter. But Ezekiel, they all fit together. And very often Ezekiel would see things by the Spirit occurring in the second heavens. That's where he was seeing. The second heavens is the location or the place of visions. People have a vision. They are seeing things happening in a different dimension than the three dimensions that we know of on the earth. Actually, there are four dimensions in each of the three heavens. In our lowest dimension, which is what we would call the first heaven, that's what we live in now, that's why, it's supposed to be heaven. We pray, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Heaven on earth is a very good expression. This is the goal. It is to reclaim the land here so that you have what is up there shall come down here. And that is a principle that is always holding true. For good or for evil, what is up there will come down here. There is a battle going on in the second heavens. And according to the course of that battle, it then casts a shadow upon the earth, and things happen on the earth. But all things happen in the heavens before they happen on the earth. So that is why when the prophets saw in the heavens, they saw what we call prophecy. They, you know, they'd see things happening. It was on a timeless dimension, but it was a spiritual dimension, and they saw events that were going to occur or even that it had occurred on the earth. Because in the spirit, all time is one. And so you see one vision, and it could stretch all the way from creation to the end of time, all in one flash of a moment, because it's a timeless dimension. That's why very often they would see a vision, and it would part of it would be fulfilled, you know, at one time, and it'd take another 1,000 years before another part of it was fulfilled, and then it might go recycle all over again, and like a pattern, and go on and on and on like that. I know some of the prophecies in Daniel actually cycled 4 times. If you've read some of Howard Rand's writings, he shows that too. I think even Armstrong had some ideas on that as well. You know, the King of the North, King of the South, you know, battles and all this kind of stuff were fulfilled over and over again from different angles. Sometimes the King of the North was this person, sometimes that person, sometimes it was even a different nation. But the ultimate here in our day, the King of the North is one who's going to come over the North with the missiles, you see. We know them as the Soviet Union. And so this is one of the dimensions of that also. But these prophecies all apply. Because they were given in a timeless dimension and seen in the Spirit, then they are in the heavens, but when they come down to earth, it's like they go through a prism. You know, light coming through a prism, the light is refracted, you know, and you get red over here, you know, and blue and yellow and violet and all that. And so different portions of that light are fulfilled in different time dimensions when it comes into the earth. Does that make any sense? Think of it like a prism. But when viewed in the heavens, it's all one. It's all one event. You recall when Jesus began his ministry, he quoted from Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to heal the sick and the blind and lame and so on. And then he stopped in the middle of it. He did not quote and proclaim the day of vengeance of our God, because that was a different time period. There was really 2,000 years between the two events. Again, it appears in Isaiah as one single prophecy, and there doesn't seem to be any break in there. But, you see, when it comes down through the prism, there's a 2,000 year span of difference here. You see? That makes it a little bit hard for us to comprehend and to understand prophecy, because what appears to our minds when we read these things, you know, the prophets and so on, what appears to be all one event or all one word may not necessarily be all for one time period. There were prophecies about Tyre, the destruction of Tyre. And they said it would be destroyed and so on. Well, and they said it would be just cast into the sea, and the very dust of the rocks would be scraped off and thrown into the sea. Well, Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed the city. They didn't throw anything into the sea. You see? It took another 150 years for Alexander the Great to come and decide he was going to take that little island out there where the Tyrians escaped and went over there. But how does he get over there? He didn't have any ships, so he took all the rocks from the city and threw them into the ocean and built a causeway out there and took the city. And so prophecy was fulfilled. But it took another 150 years. See? Kind of how it works. So anyway, you have three heavens. You have the highest heaven, where the river of life is and the throne of Yahweh. You have the second heaven, which we sometimes call in the spirit, or I usually use the term the second heavens. It makes it in relation to the third heavens. Most people can understand that better. And then you have the physical universe, or heaven on earth, where eventually the New Jerusalem shall come down out of heaven onto the earth. The New Jerusalem, Revelation 21. That is the goal of history. See? When that happens, then you have a unification of and a purification of an emerging of the three heavens into one, so that all three heavens agree. The ultimate goal is for two or three witnesses to establish every matter. You have here a full three heavens. You actually have two, and with one in the middle that is also called heaven. So you have two or three witnesses. And when all three are in agreement, then you have the end of time. Okay? Turn to 1 Kings 6, verse 8. Here you have an illustration of this in the building of the temple in Jerusalem. 1 Kings 6, 8. While he's building this, it says, the door for the middle chamber was in the right side of the house, and they went up with winding stairs into the middle chamber and out of the middle into the third. What actually you have here, if you have the New American Standard also, it shows that you have a three-story building here. Solomon's temple was a three-story building. It had three dimensions in the width. Okay, you had the outer court, you had the holy place, and you had the Holy of Holies. So it pictures essentially body, soul, and spirit, of which we are. It pictures us. We are his temples. But more than that, you also have three dimensions going up. You see? And so you have essentially the first heaven, second, and the third. The activity that we know of occurs in the first heavens, down on the ground. You see? But it doesn't develop the idea much here. We don't even know really what the purpose of those other stories were up there, I guess. Maybe somebody else does. I don't know. Anybody else know? Teach me something? I'd sure love to know that sometime. But anyway, I'm not learned enough to know that, I guess. But it does show that there is three heavens. Okay. Now, each heaven, as I said, has four dimensions. Length, width, depth are at least three. We all know that we have at least three dimensions, right? You know, this way, that way, and this way. There's a fourth dimension, which is a timeless dimension, or is actually a time dimension, timeless. The fourth dimension is a spiritual dimension. I guess that's what we usually call it. It is in the world, but it is spiritual. The spirit and the soul transcend time through the faculty of imagination. I don't know of any other word to use, but it's so similar to the mind's imagination that you have to pretty well use that terminology. You have the mind of Christ and you have our minds. There is a difference. You have his imagination, we have our imaginations. We don't want to walk after the imaginations of our own heart, but we do want to be in his image. Okay? In his imagination. And that, when we learn that type of thing, that type of spiritual activity, mostly through prayer, mostly through fellowship with him, because he rubs off on us, in doing this, we then begin to learn how to move in that timeless dimension in the heavens in the spirit. It's not really difficult. Most people think it is because they don't recognize it when it's there. It's not difficult. Some people have easier time with it than others. A week ago, I was praying with one young lady, and I said, let's go back to creation. I said, do you believe in pre-existence? No. I said, good, neither do I, but something happened back there anyway. I can't prove it theologically. I've written against it. I've preached against it. But, hey, I remember some things that happened back then, so what can I say? All right. So this goes against my own personal theology, but, hey, that's the way it is. There's some things that I have seen back there. So let's go back there and see. Well, what do you see? Well, talk about the garden and various other things. And you know something? She saw everything that I knew and had been revealed to me over a period of 3 years. She saw exactly the same thing, right down to the name of the angel that was involved in ministry there in the garden in relation to her and to me also and to this and that. She knew every detail, and I was astounded. So was she. But you see, in entering that timeless dimension, I don't know if we literally existed back there or if we were just in the image of God. It does not matter to me. The point is, it happened, whether it's in his image, in his mind, or literally. I don't know. But it happened, and you see, it bore double witness. We saw the same things. And we're talking details that would be like one out of a million to be able to guess. There were about six or seven specific details. See, it works. But you have to be in a timeless dimension to do that. You can enter into the heavens, into the spirit like that, and you can go all the way back to the beginning, and it is though it is right now. Everything is now in the spirit. That's why in the Bible, if I'm not mistaken, some of you can correct me if I'm wrong, the Hebrew doesn't really have past or future. It's just really now. You have to look at the context to know if it's past or future. But it's also why very often the Father says, I have done this, I have done that. What do you mean, have done this? It's not going to come to pass for another 2,000 years. What do you mean, have done this? Well, all time is one. When he says it's done, it's done. You see? But he speaks from a timeless dimension, which goes over our heads because we don't understand that. We are bound by time. But it is time that we move out of our carnality, out of our mental ideas of what things are, out of this three-dimensional existence that we have. It's time we start moving in the spirit. There's biblical terminology also. Walk in the spirit. Walk in the spirit. What's he talking about? It is another dimension that we are to walk in. You can fight battles on earth, or you can fight battles in the heavens. On earth, you're up against Zog, which has a lot more firepower than you ever will. They've got a lot more money than you ever will. They've got a lot more people than you ever will. A lot more newspapers, a lot more media. They've got everything that we don't have. But you go into the spirit, and we've got the edge, a big edge, you see? Then we're fighting on our turf. We have weapons that they cannot conquer. So we fight in the carnal realm. It's very hard to win anything. I'm not saying we can't do that or shouldn't do that. I'm saying that it's very hard to win. But you go in the Spirit, and as led by the Spirit, you can't lose. And it's like our brother was talking about a little earlier here. You pray first, binding and loosing. That is a faith work. That is a spiritual work, if indeed it is done in the Spirit, which obviously it was because you got results, right? I mean, the proof is in the pudding. You know that it works if it works. You know that it's real if it works. If it doesn't work, let's try something different. I go to some churches once in a while, and when I leave, nothing has changed. We go, we come, we leave. My life isn't changed, hasn't changed a bit. I look around, nobody else's life has changed. From one week to another, or from one day to another, they don't know what was preached even. They forget. Their lives haven't been changed. All they've come is out of duty. If that is all that this religion is all about, we might as well pack it up and go home. If you've come here and you leave the same person that you were, why did you come? We're no better than everybody else that we tend to criticize, right? That is why it is my responsibility, all of ours really, but I take it very personally. I must give you life. I must feed you life, not just carnality. Not just my words, not just my ideas. I can't just teach you scriptures. I have to minister. The scriptures, anybody can read the scriptures. You know, there's atheists who read the scriptures. No problem. It never produces faith in them. A lot of Christians read the scriptures. It doesn't produce faith. It just gives them knowledge. Knowledge is good, but it's not faith. Faith comes by hearing. You don't hear necessarily by reading, but you can hear while you read. You can hear while somebody talks to you. In fact, you can hear the word when you're traveling along, and like Balaam learned, he heard the word coming from his donkey. That's a word of Yahweh coming from a donkey. You've got to be kidding me. You know, he's not very picky. We're picky. We insist, you know, we'll only hear it from the Bible, or we'll only hear it from some super spiritual person, or some well-known evangelist, or from the preacher, or the priest, or the pope, or the big apostle, or something. But you know, he's not picky. I hear the word all the time. I hear it through you. I hear it through the speakers. If we're listening, we'll hear it. Our job is to subdue the earth under his feet. You have the first creation in Genesis 1:1. Brother mentioned that just a few minutes ago. And then you have the rebellion. The angels that sinned, 2 Peter 2:4. The angels that did not preserve their own principality but left their proper habitation, Jude 6. The dragon that dragged a third of the stars and cast them to the earth, Revelation 12:4. Now all of these have a number of levels of interpretation. And, you know, the thing is, these are spiritual events. And if you try to limit the fulfillment of these to any one particular interpretation, you've only got a partial picture. These are events which occurred in the heavens as a pattern, and they are repeated really many times throughout history in different ways. The captivity of Israel, for instance, a third of the stars drawn into captivity. But it's more than that. It's more than that. See? The earth became a wasteland, Genesis 1:2. There's more to this than meets the eye. In John 1:1-4, you have an interesting little statement about this, about the separation of light and darkness. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light of men. The light of men. When he separated the light from the darkness, what he was doing was setting a spiritual pattern in the heavens for the separation of light and darkness. the children of light versus the children of darkness. See? There was a pattern set. And then that pattern comes down to earth and is repeated, and you have really throughout all of history a continual separation process between light and darkness, between the children of light and children of darkness, between those who have life in them, which is the light of men, and those who have death in them, which is the death of men, the darkness, right? So you have the kingdom of light versus the kingdom of darkness. You have two kingdoms here, and they cannot coexist. They do, but they won't. They won't because this is not the goal of history. There are some who think that the goal of history is to completely separate light from darkness, and so you have heaven over here and hell over here, and you know, people go into their various places, and that's it. See, you have the yin and the yang, you know, the positive, negative, light, darkness, and so on. That is Persian dualism. That says that evil and good are equal but opposing forces. They merged or mixed in the fall, and the purpose of creation is to simply separate them so that you have darkness here and light here. It's not the case. That idea crept in through Persian dualism. What you have in the Bible is taught the complete eradication of darkness. There will be no more darkness. You see? The whole idea behind creation is to subdue all of creation under his feet. There's no room for darkness. It'll all be light. It will be the completion, or the completion of the merging of the heavens and the earth. When the third heavens and the first heavens are in total agreement with each other, first, second, and third heavens. How can you have agreement, total agreement with each other, if you have some darkness over in one half of the creation? You can't. That would mean you'd have to have half a darkness up there in the third heavens, and there's no such thing. You see? So, Adam was given authority to subdue the earth under God. Genesis 1, 26 to 28. Let them have dominion. The law of dominion. That was a law which Yahweh himself abides by. He set it up specifically to make it tough on himself because he needed a good challenge. Okay? How can he limit himself and still then complete his purpose? Now that's one of those enigmas that it's hard to figure, okay? How do you eradicate darkness completely if you take it out of your hands and give it to men to have dominion over the earth? And incidentally, that law is very real. Man has dominion over the earth to subdue it. Why do you suppose Jesus had to become a man in order to have dominion? Think about that. Could he not have just come from heaven, you know, or whatever, and be in an angelic form or a spiritual being, and have dominion over the earth, set himself up as king and have a kingdom? Well, he could have done it, except for this law of dominion that the Father set up at the very beginning. And so, in order for him to have dominion over the earth, he had to become a man of the line of Adam. He had to. More specifically of Abraham, and even more specifically of David. Because this was the line, the lineage, which held the birthright, which held the lawful dominion to rule the earth. Adam was the first king. He passed it on to Seth. Seth was the king of the earth. And it went, you know, to Methuselah, to Noah, and to Shem, to Abraham, to Isaac, Jacob, finally to Judah, and on down to David and to Christ. Each one of these, they have the lawful authority of dominion over the earth as the king of all the kings on the earth. And that culminated with Christ. You see? But how could he do that unless he was born among his brethren as a man, as a son of man? That is the term son of man. Son of Adam. Adam means man, see? He's son of God, but he could not rule the earth as son of God. He rules heaven as son of God. He rules earth as son of man. He had to hold both titles. in order to lawfully rule the earth. So the idea of creation is to find all things in submission under him. Now, he is picking out his cabinet. We are his body. Okay? Therefore, all authority that was given him over earth, he has now given to us. Now, I'll qualify that. You don't get that authority unless you earn it. Authority is not given indiscriminately to everybody. Just throw it up in the air and whoever catches it gets it. It doesn't work that way. He will not have any tyrants to rule in his kingdom. I'm sorry. He will have no tyrants. He will have no one rule over his fellow man, whoever it might be, no matter what area of dominion it is. Whether you're ruling over the rocks or a farmland or a family or a church or other races or Israel, in whatever capacity you're talking about, he will not have anyone rule who does not love those that he rules over. Okay? Does that tilt a little bit? Mm-hmm. Only with love can we rule responsibly and not as tyrants. But anyway, like our brother said, he will bruise Satan under our feet, Romans 16:20. He said that we have authority over demons and serpents even. You know, Mark 16, verses 17 and 18. So he has given us all this authority, and it is to be used if we learn how to use it. But you see, we do not know how to use it until we know how to move and walk in the Spirit. Our righteousness has to exceed that of the Pharisees. If you think that you can become righteous by zealous study of the law, you'll never do what the Pharisees did. My goodness, they studied that law like you wouldn't believe. They even knew the original languages. Hey, they studied it right down. They had so much study, they had to compile it in 66 volumes, which we call the Talmud. And they massacred it. But boy, I tell you, they dissected that Bible right down to the little bitty thing. Of course, they dissected it so that the frog didn't even look like a frog anymore. See, they completely twisted it, and they missed the whole point of it. But that's the Pharisaical approach to the Scriptures. I'm afraid that we have a tendency to do that ourselves. We have a tendency to do what the Pharisees did. Whatever the Pharisees believed about themselves, we believe about ourselves. Think about that. Let's be careful that we don't end up as Pharisees like they were, okay? Because we can. I'm not talking racial. I'm talking attitudes, okay? I won't get into anything specific there. You can think about that yourself. There are certain spiritual laws. There are laws of the Spirit. Without knowing the physical laws or the moral laws of the first five books of the Bible, really the whole Bible, but without learning the law as it applies in physical governments, you really will not be able to fully comprehend and even know how these laws apply in the Spirit. On the other hand, if you do not know how the laws apply in the Spirit, you will not really know how to apply the laws properly in the world. I say that because I say it from personal experience. I learned the laws more than anybody at one time. But when it came right down to it, until by revelation I was shown how these laws apply in the second heavens, in spiritual warfare, in changing things, in working with patterns and so on in the heavens, which then come into the earth, it was not until I began working in the Spirit and the Spirit of the law and seeing how these were spiritual laws, not until then did I really understand how to use these laws and apply them as he meant them to be applied in the earth, in government, in family, in churches, with our fellow men. And so it's important. We get off the beaten track and we just, it's appalling to me how we who think we know the law so well can violate it so horribly. I know I speak from personal experience. I've done it, and I cringe when I think of the past. And now, too, you know. And I just back off, and I'm very careful about using the law now until I understand it. But it's your daily walk with Him. As you walk in the Spirit, you come into conflict. I've gone into spiritual warfare and fought in the heavens and so on. And things happen up there, and I say, why did that happen? By what law? And He tells me, by the law of such and such. I say, oh, that's what that law means. Now I understand. Intercession, for instance. How can you intercede and take on yourself the sins of somebody else? That's what Jesus did, right? Isaiah 53. He bore our iniquities. That's what Ezekiel did when he laid on his side for 390 days. You shall bear their iniquities. That's not just something that Christ did. That is something we all do on behalf of Him because we are His body and we have to live His life. How do we do that? How do we bear somebody else's iniquities? That's impossible, isn't it? Not in the spiritual realm. You can't do it physically. You'll die because the wages of sin is death. But in the spiritual realm, you learn to walk in the Spirit. We call it intercession. You take on yourselves the faults of your neighbor or their sin. You actually will feel their pain. You will actually experience the penalty for their sin. Now that takes love. You cannot do intercession without loving the person you're interceding for. You can't do it. And furthermore, they will be very glad to help you along in your intercession. They'll crucify you. See? They're very helpful. Is it for their benefit? No, it's for our benefit. You see? Don't worry about them. Worry about yourself. Thank your Heavenly Father that He has given you that opportunity. Because when it's all over, then they crucify you, then you are raised up in glory and given a name that is above their name, not in the same sense that Christ is, of course, but as His body, you are seated in His throne. You are an ascended being after that. You do ascend. You come to the place of abiding in Him where He is. But where He is, you may be also. That's the place of abiding in Him. From that position, you are given authority. Check Ephesians 2. He was placed at the right hand of the Father, far above all authority and power on the earth. And we have been seated with Him in heavenly places. Not automatically. You have to go through the same steps that He did as an intercessor. You have to live as He did, at least in type form. You have to intercede. You have to know what it means to die, and you have to know what it means to be raised from the dead. I'm not talking physical. I'm talking a process. I'm talking an intercessory process, because then when you are placed with Him in His throne, you then have authority, spiritual authority over those that you interceded for. When you have that authority, then can be applied the law of Numbers, chapter 20, is it? 30? 30. The law of veto. You know what I'm talking about? A man has the authority to veto any rash decision or vow that his daughter or his wife made. Remember that? You think that just applies in the world? No. If you have spiritual authority and you see one who is in your jurisdiction, in your authority by the Spirit, who is making a rash vow, or what we would say, making a decision that is contrary to Yahweh, and you know it, you have a responsibility by that law of veto. You can veto their decision. I've done it, and it works. But you cannot do it until you have authority. You see? Authority is not given lightly. He does not give His authority lightly. You earn it. And believe me, it costs. It costs a lot. When you learn to die, though, when you learn to be crucified and to rise again as an intercessor, you'll never be the same again. And you learn then, when you get into a position where you can love those who crucify you, you'll have learned the great lesson of history that we are to learn. The same thing that our Savior learned. You see? He'll have no tyrants ruling in his kingdom. If you want to rule and reign with him, you have to die, and you have to learn to love those who crucify you. Now, I'm not saying you have to learn to love those who love you. I'm not saying you have to learn to love those who crucify you blindly or who do good only. The ones you love are the very ones who are guilty. They don't deserve anything. They deserve nothing. But that's the whole point. If we only love those who love us, what reward do we have? Even the publicans do the same, right? That's what he said. There are laws of the Spirit. There's a spiritual law of life, Romans 8:2. It's brought into the world by Jesus' resurrection, 2 Timothy 1:10. It frees us from the law of sin and death, Romans 8:2. This life is the light of men, John 1:4. We are translated out of darkness into his kingdom as citizens. And by this law, we bring forth the man-child within us. Do you know the concept of the man-child being brought in? It is the individual application of the national promise to Israel in Isaiah 66 and in Revelation 12. Study it sometime. It is the culmination of what we know as Christ in us, the hope of glory. He is in us, and he is being brought to birth within us. And until we learn how to bring the man-child to birth within us, we will never be transformed, never metamorphosized, as we heard just in the last, what Brother Ralph was saying. You see, how are we going to be transformed? There's an enzyme in here, there's an enzyme up here. But why don't they ever meet? Why are we never transformed? It is because we have never yet brought forth the man-child, which is really just another way of saying we are metamorphosized, we are transformed into his likeness and his image. That hasn't been done yet in the history of the church, except one person, Jesus Christ. He is in the process of duplicating himself in us. What do you suppose Pentecost was all about? He could have just done it all himself, but he says, no, I have to go to the Father so I can send the Spirit upon you so that we can transform you and make you into little Christ, Christians. He's duplicating himself in us. We then live his life. People see us, they see the Father, they see him. Until we reach that point, we still have not attained. And there is no life in us, there's no power in us. You know, we have a tendency to criticize people who believe in false doctrines or whatever. You know something, I found something interesting. The Father even loves people who believe false doctrines. That was one of the first lessons that I learned that blew my mind away. I said, come on, you can't be true. Why, he even speaks to people who believe false doctrine. You know what a false doctrine is. It's something that I don't believe. So that's the way it is, isn't it? I mean, we all think that way. And strangely enough, I found that if that were the case, he would have only spoken to one man on earth 2,000 years ago. But it doesn't work that way. He loves us anyway. He has made us diverse, not only diverse in height, shape, weight, male, female, etc., but also gifts and callings and levels and all sorts of different things. He loves variety. It's all through creation. And, you know, I found that he makes us a little different, even in our beliefs. Why? So that we learn to love one another. You're a Sabbathite. You're a Sundayite. You're a sacred namist. And you believe that Israel. Somebody else does not believe we're physical Israel. And you're a racist, and you're not a racist, and all these different things, okay? You believe that going to hell when you die, and other people, no, you don't. You just annihilate. And others say, no, you don't do that either. You go to some limbo. We have all different things. We have all different beliefs. Well, what is our common ground? Do we rally around the banner of a doctrine? Well, that's what denominations do. My belief is the greatest. You aren't a Christian unless you believe this doctrine. You've got to be one of us. Wait a minute now. We're a family, as you just learned last time. What is the basis of our familyhood? We have one Father, right? Isn't that sufficient to make us a family? Now, I'm not just talking racially here. We have to be able to come to the place where we can discern by the Spirit who is the family and who isn't. What did Jesus say? They said, the disciples said, oh, your family is out here. You know, your mother, your brothers are out here. They want to talk to you. He says, who are my mother? Who's my brothers? Those who do the will of my Father. You see? Let's give up the idea of just purely family from a fleshly point of view. When we know, see, I look out and I can see, you know, I discern spirit. There's a spirit of that. There's either enemies or they're either for you or against you. You see? We can have a family relationship that is purely by the Spirit, regardless. Mike and I were talking about this too, just kind of earlier. You know, Mike and I are different. You know, you believe one thing, I believe another. Fine, then no problem. We don't argue, we get along okay. You see? So long as he doesn't step on my toes, I won't beat him over the mouth. Okay, we get along fine. But, you see, we can be a family so long as we know each other by the Spirit. Paul says that he is determined not to know anybody but by the flesh, but by the Spirit only. He's going to know Christ not by the flesh, but after the Spirit. This is what we need to know. We need to discern this. Who are our brethren by a spiritual discernment, you see? Now, that won't make much sense to you until you begin to actually experience it. When I've been in spiritual warfare, I've been confronted by certain people that very, very much surprised me. Cut them down in the spirit, in the heavens, in warfare. They're opposing Yahweh's army, and they're opposing his purpose, and without any hesitation, just chop them down. That's a fearful thing. It scared me to death. Not literally, but it scared the daylights out of me, because I realized what was going to happen, and sure enough, those people died within a year. You see? But what is it? You see, by spiritual discernment, I did not know that they were my enemies until I came across them in spiritual warfare and discovered suddenly they were. It never ceases to amaze me. The people that I think are my friends turn out to be the enemies, and vice versa. Jesus had the same problem. Why, you'd think that the religious leaders would have accepted him and so on. No, it's the publicans and the harlots that accepted him. It doesn't make sense. It should not be, but this is the way it is. But how do you know except by spiritual discernment? You see, it's very important. You have the spiritual law of faith. Faith is the bridge that spans the 12 dimensions, or the three heavens. Heaven comes to earth only across the bridge of faith. You build that by faith. Faith he gives you, but you have to do something too. You build it. Heaven on earth begins with personal justification by faith. Then there's a spiritual law of reproduction. The origin of all flesh is spirit. The spiritual reality is the tree that produces the fruit on earth after its kind. What happens in the spirit occurs then on the earth, according to after its kind. You see, there is a spiritual law of reproduction here. What you see in the spirit, you can alter and change its genes or whatever by prayer and by intercession. But once it is set and established, then it bears fruit on the earth after its kind. Spirit forms the pattern for the fleshly manifestation, because events first occur in the spiritual realm before manifesting on the earth. So these spiritual events descend through the 12 dimensions into the earth, and as it gets closer and closer, you can see it. I've monitored these down through various stages of development as it's come into the earth, and each time it gets a little clearer, a little bit more. You know, the cycles that come through, like in Daniel, the four times, it keeps coming. It's coming closer and closer to the earth. And every time it does, it's almost like it goes down the mountain like this. You know, first it comes in first this way, and then it comes in reverse pattern, and then back this way and back this way. It's just something that I've observed over the years, and we've observed over the years. On earth as it is in heaven, faith is a bridge between the dimensions. The second heaven is the battleground. As we enter into that realm and change things, because prayer does change things, we can eventually work. Our Father works His will through His body. And as that occurs, heaven is then brought to earth. But heaven will not be brought to earth until the pattern is completely set in heaven. All enemies must be thrown out of the second heaven like they were thrown out of the third. We have in Revelation 12 that Satan was cast out of heaven, the third heaven. But on the way down, he made a long stop in the second heaven. He is the prince of the power of the air, the firmament, you see? And there's where the battleground is. We fight him in the battleground there and cast him down to the earth. But then we got real problems on earth. But you see, once we cast him down to the earth, we have a spiritual pattern laid of a building process of the New Jerusalem. Once that is completely built, and it is built by faith, then and only then can it move through faith into the world. Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.